I just flew in from Israel this morning. I felt it's appropriate for me to be speaking about this particular topic because airline travel in general for me is a near-death experience. So you really know it's not going well when you console yourself on the airplane and saying, you know, it could crash. You know, in this case, the flight will be over. So, but I flew El Al and it was wonderful. El Al has greatly improved their service, and in fact, they're only allowed to hit you open-handed now, which is very good. And I was upgraded to business. I was actually upgraded to business class, and they're only allowed to verbally abuse you. So it was very good. Now I hope everyone has a an outline, because everything on here will be on the final at the end of the seminar. That will count for 12% of your mark. So also you're contributing to the deforestation of Brazil. So please take them. There's a few, you know, the worst sin the Jewish people ever did. What is the worst sin the Jewish people ever did? No private personal information is necessary here. But the worst sin that the Jews ever did as a people was the worship of the golden calf. You familiar with this? After Mount Sinai, 1313 BCE, Middle Bronze Age interchange period, Jewish people come to the Mount Sinai, Revelation, and then they worship the golden calf. And the Talmud, or it's actually explicit in the verse, states that what was the motivation of the Jews? It says, Vayar ha'am, and the people saw ki boshesh Moshe laredet min ha'har. The people saw that Moses was late in coming down the mountain, and hence they fashioned for themselves a golden calf, an idol. And since that time, as atonement for that terrible sin, we have always refused to look at our watches. Now, Jews no longer say, oh, it's late. You know, they just forget it, because the first time we said it was late, what happened was a very terrible tragedy. My teachers always told me that if you see people in the audience looking at their watches while you're speaking, just ignore it. The only time you should be worried is they start doing that. There's actually a famous priest who used to give very long sermons at his church, and a fellow went out during one of the sermons, walked out in the middle. And the priest came to him the next Sunday before services, and he said, like, why did you walk out during my sermon? He says, I went to get a haircut. He says, in the middle of a sermon, you had to get a haircut then? He says, it wasn't long when I came in. So in any case, now that we're in the mood to talk about euthanasia, let us begin. What I'd like to cover, first of all, just in general, there's a lot of confusion in the world about these issues. The previous Surgeon General, former Surgeon General of the United States, C. Everett Koop, in one of his books, talks about the slide towards Auschwitz, in which he talks about a steady erosion of the value of human life in the legal system of the United States. He says that we are continuously, and people around the world are doing this, I should not only say the United States, this is true in many, many countries in the world, there is an erosion of the value of human life. A human life is being judged on a qualitative basis. Human life is being judged on how long it is. Human life is being judged on the quality of life. And he says, with that type of attitude, there is a slippery slope that one takes that is very, very dangerous. Okay. That is very dangerous. And he warns that... I see the director here. I should not have started. I'm too early. The mic. Can people hear me? That's fine then. That's fine. Okay. When I start doing rap, I'll hold the mic. But at the moment, we'll just talk. Okay. So now... that is one. There's one issue. In fact, there's a philosopher by the name of Peter Singer, an Australian philosopher who's unfortunately Jewish, and he is, I think, teaching now at Yale, teaching philosophy at Yale. His opinion is that life has no intrinsic value whatsoever. The only thing that has value is happiness. Peter Singer advocates that a child should not be considered alive until they're 3 days old. So you can evaluate if they'll be worth keeping them alive. And, Oh, it's Princeton, is it? I'm sorry. He's a professor of Princeton, head of bioethics. And he advocates, for instance, when a person gets to a certain age, they should be considered legally dead. And that way, you can advocate, that way it's possible to evaluate, are they going to be contributing, is their quality of life worthwhile? And obviously, as he gets older, that age limit gets a little further along, as you know, as one would imagine. Well, not 60 anymore, 65. You know. So, but again, that's what he advocates. And unfortunately, he's a son of Holocaust survivors, and to see a man advocating that type of idea, where we're redefining and redefining and redefining, and until we really have no value whatsoever left to life. In the medical world, one of the main principles that is operated on is the idea of the patient's right to choose. It's also not always so clear-cut, as we'll see in Judaism, but even in the world in general, it's not always so clear-cut. A good friend of mine, Dr. Westreich, when he was on a trauma team at a hospital in Toronto, North York Hospital, I think it was, there was a Jewish man, a very elderly Jewish man, who was went into cardiac arrest, and the trauma team was called in an emergency, and there was no order signed of do not resuscitate. There's no DNR order signed, do not resuscitate. But on the other hand, the man had screamed a number of times, I want to die, I want to die. Screaming, I want to die. And they did not know what to do. You touch him, you get sued. You don't touch him, you get sued. I mean, what are they? So in the end, the hospital decided not to do anything. As it happened, he recovered. And my friend went to visit him afterwards, and he said, we didn't know what to do. You were yelling, I want to die. And he says, you bunch of idiots. When I have my tooth out, I yell, I want to die as well. Doesn't mean I want to die. It's the pain. So again, we have to be very careful here to know exactly what the laws are. So what I'd like to address are these following questions up on the board here. First of all, what's the obligation of the physician in Jewish law? We won't be able to give an absolutely definitive answer. We cannot give black and white. We can give some general rules. Application in individual cases, obviously, is the type of thing that a competent Jewish legal authority has to be consulted on, which I am not. And what we can do, however, is give some general rules and guidelines. Yep. Fine. At least it was. Okay, now, first of all, is the obligation of the obligation of the physician. I actually saw a concert of, Keith Richard from the Rolling Stones. And they weren't sure if the feedback was because of the microphone or his pacemaker. It was one of the two. Anyway. So we have got the value of life. The second aspect of it is what's the value of life in Jewish philosophy and Jewish law. The third is who owns life, who has the right to make decisions about life and end-of-life decisions, etc. Number four, is it life at all costs? Are there situations where we would have something that overrides life in Judaism? And five, who's on first? Are there priorities in terms of saving life, in terms of sacrificing, that we have to follow? So just at the bottom there, I just thought that name there, the Hebrew there, Chavakuk. Anyone who Chavakuk was? Anyone heard of Chavakuk? He was one of the prophets. In English, Habakkuk. Chavakuk, one of the great prophets. The Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, one of the great Kabbalists, points out that Chavakuk, his name is composed, the repetition of the last letter in Hebrew is a repetition of what the whole word means. So the word actually means Chavak, which means, anyone know what Chavak means? To embrace or to hug. Chavakuk means someone who's been embraced twice, hugged twice. And in fact, the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, says Chavakuk was the son of the Shunammit, a woman who was promised a son by a prophet, by Elisha, and the son was in the field and died, and the prophet came and brought him back to life. And he promised this woman, before the son was born, he said, at this time next year, at Choveket Ben, you will embrace a child. So she embraced the child twice, once when he was first born and once when he was reborn. I just mentioned this because my own son, my youngest son, 3 years old, when he was born, he had some severe lung problems. And the first 3, he was on a respirator for weeks. And I remember the doctors, a couple of the doctors saying after 3 days, that he was not going to make it over Shabbat. It was a Friday night, and he was not going to make it through the Shabbat, and they said, really, it's not much use to keep him on. And we decided to continue, and he, Baruch Hashem, thank God, is a healthy, happy boy now, and he pulled through, and I wanted to call him Chavakuk. My initial thought was to call him Chavakuk, because he was embraced twice. He was embraced once at the birth, and he was embraced a second time, almost at the rebirth, thanks to the, thanks first of all to the miracle of Hashem, and doing it through the care of the doctors at Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem. So actually my teacher said, don't call him Chava Cook, Chava, because people think it's a girl whose name is Chava Cook. So we called him instead Aryeh, which is the same numerical value as Chavakuk, as the Arizal also points out. In any case, so that's just a personal note on the value of life and when people say to give up and not give up. This woman, the mother of Chavakuk, did not give up at any point. And we now have a book of prophecy based on that. Now, first of all, the obligation of the physician. If you look at the outlines, the methodology of Jewish law is to look back at the original sources, look back at our sources, and try to understand from the Makorot, from the sources, to apply them in life today. So what I'd like to look at is some primary sources. The Talmud is for us the prime source for Jewish law. We'll discuss, I think we're going to discuss on Sunday, the idea of the oral law. In Judaism, we don't just open the Bible and say, well, it says this, let's go. That's not how we do it. It's much more complex than that. We look at the Talmud generally as our source of law. So let me go through a couple of the major Talmudic sources here. First of all, the Talmud quotes the verse in Leviticus, number one, you shall not stand by the blood of your neighbor. Lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Do not stand by the blood of your neighbor. In most legal systems, you do not find obligation. What you find are transgressions. You find you've got a crime. If you do this, you've done a crime. But obligations are not that common. They're rare. In Jewish law, you have an obligation. You're not allowed to stand idly by the blood of your fellow man. You have to actually do something. The Talmud says, how do we know? If one sees a fellow man drowning in a river, being attacked by a wild animal, threatened by bandits, he's obligated to save him. The Torah teaches us this by saying, you shall not stand by the blood of your friend. In other words, that in all, it covers a number of different scenarios here, a person drowning in a river, attacked by a wild animal, threatened by bandits, perhaps divine providence, but that some cases it's human free will, maybe it's his negligence being in the river. In any of the cases, it's irrelevant. You're not allowed to stand idly by, and in Jewish law, the physician, or whoever is capable of saving the person, which usually happens to be a physician in the case of a medical problem, is obligated to do something, to intervene. You cannot, one of the options we have is not nothing. That's not an option. Yeah.
Brother Randy, how do you reconcile that with the Good Samaritan laws, which frequently are used adversarially against Good Samaritans to intervene in life-saving situations?
I can't reconcile that. That's not Jewish legal system. That's in the American legal system. And the American legal system is not the same. I just want to point out, this is something seasonal, that in Jewish history, there was no such thing as a good Samaritan. They were bad Samaritans. The Samaritans were a group of people, non-Jews, who were brought into Israel by the Assyrians after they decimated and exiled the northern 10 tribes of Israel. The Samaritans were pagans who were brought into Israel and were a thorn in the side of the Jewish people for 1,000 years. They informed on us to enemies. They tried to convince Alexander of Macedon to destroy the temple. When Jews rebuilt the temple at the time of the second temple of Ezra, they had to have a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. The sword was to defend against the Samaritans. The Samaritans were the last people likely to help a poor suffering Jewish beggar by the side of the road. The Pharisees, Hillel, Shammai, Rabbi Akiva, etc., they were the first people you'd expect to help a poor suffering beggar. But in Christian scriptures, they scored a tremendous propaganda victory here. And what they did was they took the enemies of the Jewish people, they took the person least likely to do the righteous deed, and they put the Pharisees walking by and ignoring a beggar. And who's the person that helps him? The Good Samaritan.
Were the Samaritans Jews, rather?
The Samaritans became, whether they're not, now they're not Jews, but they some say they actually converted to Judaism. Whether it was sincere or not, whether it was a real conversion or not, is a matter of controversy. I just want to, you know, just as a parenthetical, that the idea of the Good Samaritan is a very Christian concept, and it's a, we look at them as the, the nasty, mean Samaritans. In any case, so now, the good Pharisee. Pharisee, of course, became an expression as the Oxford Dictionary defines it for someone who's a hypocrite. That's us, the rabbis, Pharisees. Right? So we've got a, unfortunately, the English language has in it many elements which are not quite ideal. But anyway, close the parentheses now, you can now listen. Okay, so now, how do we know, then the Gemara goes on, how do we know there's an obligation to restore someone's loss of body to them? What does that mean? That does not mean someone got lost while doing astral travel. Right? Loss of body means the following, that it means that someone lost the use of a limb, or they are in pain, they cannot use their body, they cannot fulfill, they cannot function properly, so you're obligated to return it, the Talmud says. The Torah teaches us this by saying, you shall surely return it to him, in reference to his property, how much more so regarding his body. This is what we call a fortiori reasoning, in Latin, in Hebrew, kal vachomer. If you are obligated to return something as pathetically insignificant as a person's wallet, how much more so are you obligated to restore to them their health? It's what's called kavod, used all the time in Judaism. We had a girl come to our house once in Toronto, said, hello, would you like a free copy of the Toronto Star? And I said, absolutely not. I don't like the newspaper, I do not even want a free copy. She said, would you like to buy a subscription? I said, have you ever studied in yeshiva? She said, huh? I said, if I do not want a free copy, how much more so will I not want a subscription? Right. Obvious. Anyone who's been to even one seminar here will be able to. So, that's what the Talmud says. But again, we see you have an obligation, restoring loss of body, restoring health to someone. You shall keep my statutes, my commandments, that a person shall do and live by them. I am God. There's a verse in Leviticus, the original Hebrew. V'chai b'hem, ashiyasa oisam ha'odam, v'chai b'hem, the commandments that a person shall do, v'chai b'hem, and live in them. The commandments were given to live in them. What does that mean? Shmuel said, you shall live by them and not die by them. That in fact, life takes precedent over virtually all the commandments, with the exception of three, murder, idolatry, and sexual immorality. But in regards to all the other commandments, life takes precedence. We see there's an imperative to live, there's an imperative to restore someone's health, use of body, use of limb to them, and there is an imperative, there's a prohibition against standing idly by. So inaction is not really an option. To stand there and say, I'm just let things take their course, usually, we will see, maybe there are some exceptions to this, but on the whole, one general rule we'd establish is the physician cannot evade responsibility. We cannot say, I'm just going to not do anything. I won't intervene. It's what we would call perhaps the New Yorker syndrome. No offense to anyone, right? But I don't want to get involved. Don't want to get involved. Right? So that is not an option here. In addition, number two, Babylonian Talmud Bavakama, the school of Rabbi Ishmael taught, the Torah says, you shall heal him, you shall heal him. The verse says, Verapo yirapeh. The context is, if you injured someone, God forbid, you know, fight, something like that, you injured someone, you're obligated to pay for a number of different damages. One of the damages you're obligated to pay for is medical expenses. Verapo yirapeh, you shall heal him, you shall heal him. Talmud discusses why it says it twice. You shall heal, you shall heal. So, some commentaries say that what it means is, if he has relapses as a result of the original injury that you caused, you're obligated to repeat. Now, the repetition of the verb implies repetition of the action. Others say that it's to teach us that it is actually the doctor has been given permission to heal, and as Nachmanides says, permission which is also an obligation. Why does he need permission to heal? There are a number of different explanations of this. Some would say the following. And, you know, there are religions where there's no medical intervention is looked upon in a negative way. Christian Scientists, for example. But even in the more mainstream Christianity, there's a certain attitude which is that medical treatment is somehow not quite kosher. And I use the term loosely, but, you know, right, it's not quite the ideal. And the reason for this is they believe that, look, if God afflicted the person, who am I to intervene? Who am I to intervene? Maimonides attacks this point of view. Attacks it. He says, it makes no sense whatsoever. For example, he says, why is the person saying? The person is saying, look, if God decreed, this is an incorrect religious view. If God decreed that the person will die, then all medical intervention in the world will not help. And if God decreed that he should not die, then he doesn't need medical intervention. You understand that? What is wrong with that logic? Maimonides says there's something really basically wrong with that logic. So let me give you an example to illustrate it better. You go to a mechanic, take your car to the mechanic to get a check, and the mechanic says your brake pads are down to 10%. You say, sir? And he says, what do you mean, so? You can't drive with brake pads which are down to 10%. You'll have an accident. I say, look, you are a heretic. I'm trying to fix your brakes. He says, look, don't give me that. I said, if God decrees that there will be an accident, there will be an accident even if I have 100% brake pads. And if God decreed there will not be an accident, there won't be an accident even if I have no brakes whatsoever. You are trying to steal, which may be true, but that's not the point, right? It's not the point. So now, if the mechanic is a theologian, how should the mechanic answer? What should the mechanic answer? So the answer, Maimonides says, is this. Two answers. First of all, he says, how do you know God's decrees are black and white? How do you know that God's decree is, you will have an accident no matter what you or anyone else does? Or you won't have an accident no matter what you or anyone else does? Maybe God's decrees are conditional. Clear. Maybe God's decree is the following. If this idiot doesn't change his brake pads, then he will have an accident. If he takes responsibility and does change his brake pads, then, all things equal, he won't. It could be there are other factors involved as well. But one certain factor is that you cannot know what the decree of God is unless you're a prophet. We've been a non-profit organization for over 1,000 years, right? And unless you are indeed a prophet, George Bernard Shaw used to say that if you speak to God, you're praying. If he speaks to you, you're schizophrenic. But again, the idea, though, is that we cannot know what God's decrees are. In our present situation, we can't know that. And maybe God's decree is conditional. We don't know that it's unconditional. We don't know that it's a black and white decree, and therefore we have to take responsibility. God wants us to take responsibility for our actions. So, according to some, if that's true, simple logic tells me that you're obligated to intervene. Simple logic tells me, as Maimonides says, you're obligated to take medical precaution. Why does the Torah need to give permission to the doctor to heal? There are some explanations. Some say, as Nachmanides says, Rishus de mitzvahi. It is telling us that it's an obligation for the doctor to heal. It's an obligation. And look at how many of our great sages were in fact physicians. All the way back to Shmuel in the Talmud, Maimonides, Nachmanides, Sforno, many of our great sages were physicians, and in fact it is to a great degree a Jewish provenance. So we are overrepresented, called to Marshall Sklar in America's Jews, we're overrepresented in medicine by something like 450%. I mean, it's ludicrous. It's like, you know. So remember, my sister in Australia teaches Vietnamese refugees English, so she taught them a song. It's an old English song called "The Doctor Came with His Hat and Bag." You ever heard that song? Anyway, doctor came with his hat. I won't sing it. All right. But she had a friend of ours, Jewish doctor, who came in and with his bag, and he actually happened to be wearing a yarmulke. So her Vietnamese students, she was taking them out into the city, centre city in Melbourne, and they saw a couple of people with yarmulkes, and they all say, "Doctors, doctors," because doctor came with his hat and bag is in the song, and the doctor she brings happened to have a hat. I mean, the truth is they were probably correct. You know, there's got. But anyway, also the doctor gives an obligation to heal. Some say the idea of the permission is that if the doctor acts in good faith, he is a certain indemnity against damage that he may cause. Many, many medical procedures involve pain, involve a risk, involve some type of damage. If he acts in good faith, there's a certain indemnity. He's been given permission, reshut, permission to heal. In other words, why enter into this field, a doctor may say, if when I make a mistake, I'll be prosecuted, if, etc. Torah says, act in good faith, act competently, and there's a permission for you to get involved in this. Now, that's as far as the obligation of the physician. So the obligation of the physician we see is not just to save life, that's the first source, it's also to restore health. Restore health and also to restore the person's ability to function. and also a separate issue, which is the obligation to heal in general. Now, number three, in terms of the value of life. What's the value of life? The Talmud says the following. Number three. If a person is found alive under a fallen house on the Sabbath, the debris may be removed. That is to say, you are allowed, obligated, to transgress the Sabbath in order to save life, even if it's a doubt. Even if it's a doubt of a doubt. So the person is under debris in a house, you're obligated to do so. Remove the debris, even if it means transgressing Shabbat. So the Talmud says, well, that's obvious. Of course you have, of course. Pshita, the Talmud says. It is obvious. Why do you need to state that? So the Talmud says, the answer is, this teaches us that it's obligatory to desecrate the Shabbat, even if only permitting to live for a short time. That is to say, the person who is buried under this debris, a physician looks at him, examines him part of the way, and says, he's going to live for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour. You know, are you still obligated to desecrate Shabbat to save his life? Talmud says yes, even though it's only a very short lifespan. What's the logic? Now, the Meiri, one of the great Talmudic commentaries, says the following. If when they remove the debris, they examine him and found him still alive, they can complete the removal even though he cannot live more than an hour. He doesn't mean an hour literally, he means even a moment. For in that moment, hour, he may repent and confess. Now, the Meiri says, even if he's alive only for a moment, in that moment, the person may have a consciousness of thought of coming close to God, regret the evil that he has done, and say, I want to be close to Hashem. In that moment, that's enough to gain the world to come. Now, we may look at that and say, that's very beautiful, but actually, the Mishnah Brura, one of the later halachic authorities, says that explanation of the Meiri is not true. Not correct. He says, number three, Bir Halacha, it is clear from all the sources that the saving of temporary life is obligatory, even if the victim will live only for a very short time and will be unconscious. Or even if the victim is mentally incompetent. The Meiri's rationale is only in order to make the law more palatable to people. It is for publicity purposes. To make it for most people more understandable, the Meiri says that, look, in a moment, look what you can do to give you the value of a moment. Most people don't have an idea of the value of a moment. You know, there were rabbis who on Rosh Hashanah, and they say the story about Rav Kook and other rabbis, but on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, he was standing there crying bitterly. His student asked, why are you crying? He says, there's 10 minutes this past year I cannot account for. 10 minutes of my life I cannot account for. Now, I look back on younger, I say, what the heck was I doing in the 80s? Like, there's a decade of my life. Please, you know, that's what we're like. You know, but we don't understand the value of a moment. So the Meiri is just trying to tell people the value of a moment. But the Mishnah Berurah, the Bir Halacha, says that really, that is not all there is to it. There's much more than that. He says clearly, even if the victim definitely will not repent and confess, we must nevertheless save him. Even if this person will be unconscious, the Israeli army medical unit uncovers a person. They examine him partially uncovered. It's clear he will be unconscious. It's clear he will live for a short time. Do we continue uncovering him? I just went to a seminar 2 months ago on reserve duty in the army. I'm in the Israeli army, and the unit I'm in does identification and care for the dead, etc. As part of the rabbinate, it's called Zach. Zihui Chalalim. But in the training center is what we're told, exactly what the Talmud says. It's irrelevant how conscious they'll be. It's irrelevant how long they'll live. You're obligated to save them, even if it means desecrating the Shabbat. In other words, what do we see from this idea? What is the value of life? Is the value of life based on its quality? Is the value of life based on the consciousness of the person? Or is the value of life something which is more intrinsic than that? Clearly, the value of life we see from the Chafetz Chaim is more intrinsic than the consciousness, the ability to repent. The value of life, the Chafetz Chaim is saying, is something intrinsic. And what we see is, you're allowed to transgress, obligated to transgress the Sabbath, even if that life will not have any apparent direct spiritual value. Now, if that's so, how do we understand this? Just to step out of law for the moment and try to understand it from a philosophical point of view. What is the, and this is something which really does bother people, I think, in the whole end of life issue question. Here is a person who's unconscious. Here is a person who's not functioning. What is the value of such a life? So we would say life in and of itself has a value. See, the soul, first of all, functions in this world and sometimes can function whether or not we see any signs of it in the body. That is first and foremost. Second of all, Eliyahu Dessler, one of the great ethicists and philosophers of our century, Rav Dessler says that it is possible for a soul to have an elevation, for the soul to have an increase in its closeness to God through other people being inspired by it, through other people doing things for that soul. For example, a little baby doesn't have free will. A little baby doesn't have moral consciousness, spiritual consciousness. Yet, the little baby has merit. What is the merit? Because that little baby inspires other people to do acts of kindness, inspires other people to treat it in a certain way. In other words, the fact is that it has somehow revealed godliness in the world. If I do an act of kindness, if I pray, if I visit the sick, if I do something for a person who's totally and completely unconscious, then yes, it is of certainly my merit, but I'm doing it for that person. That means they unwittingly, yes, but they are a vehicle for the revelation of God in the world. And that's really our purpose. Revelation of godliness in the world, in the human being, in nature, in every aspect of the world. In that sense, we would say, yes, could be his unconscious, could be a loop for 15 minutes. But the fact is, there's a revelation of the honor of the Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of the name of God. There's a fellow in my synagogue in Israel who is he's a medic in the paratroopers. And he was sent to Kosovo, and he was sent to Turkey, and he was sent to Greece. The Greek earthquake in Greece, earthquake in Turkey, and the military problems in Kosovo. This was all in three months before his wedding. He got back from Greece, from tending to earthquake victims, 2 days before his wedding. And he was there, I think he was there for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And you know, a lot of the people, he recovered only, sometimes it was bodies, who were people who were already dead. Sometimes he recovered people who were unconscious. But the Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of the name of God, the revelation, when a person doesn't act like that, as he did, and he's a volunteer, by the way, for two of these at least, right, when a person does an act of altruistic kindness towards someone else, doesn't matter what state of consciousness that person is in, then the person they're doing it for is a vehicle for the revelation of godliness in this world. And in that sense, there's a value even leaving aside the Meiri. So that's in terms of the value of life as far as Jewish tradition says, in terms, even if it's a short term. By the way, I should point out, look at source on the overleaf, source number 13. Source number 13 seems to be a little bit of a contradiction here. Source number 13 is a little bit of a strange source. It says the following. It says that it's forbidden to seek treatment, medical treatment, from pagans as they're suspected murderers. You see, a pagan doctor in ancient times, he was just as likely to kill you as to heal you. You go to this guy, if he was in a bad, you know, could be he was in a bad mood that day, goodbye Charlie, right? That's it. Right? If he's in a good mood, maybe he'll heal you. So the Talmud says, Mishnah says, you cannot go to such a doctor. But the Talmud asks the following question. In an even doubt of life and death, it's certainly prohibited to go to this guy. But what if the person's got a disease in which you'll certainly die in a short time? Then it's permitted. But what about the risk of a short lifespan? Talmud says we don't take that into account, short lifespan. What does it mean here? Supposing a person got a disease where if they go to this pagan doctor, he may heal it and give them a normal lifespan. If they don't go to the pagan doctor, what will happen? They'll die within a year. Less than 12 months, generally accepted as the understanding here. So, now, the pagan doctor, therefore, is, you know, try and think of it. You have to try and think, when you look at Talmud and Mishnah, you have to try to understand these things as paradigms for other situations. Don't think of a pagan doctor, because that's a very unusual situation for us. We think of it, the pagan doctor is like an experimental medical treatment. Right? If you do the experimental medical treatment, it's very like it may kill the person or it may cure them. Then you're not allowed to do it. But what if the person, God forbid, has got a sickness in which they'll anyway die within a year? Can they do the experimental treatment which may kill them but may give them a normal lifespan? Some authorities derive from this Mishnah, the pagan doctor is just an experimental medical treatment. And in the case of the short lifespan, it says we don't take it into account. Okay, so now from here, it would appear apparently to be a contradiction. An apparent contradiction. Because we said initially on the first page that the short lifespan is of intrinsic infinite value. We'll desecrate Sabbath to save him. Yet here we say, forget the short lifespan. What's the answer?
Rabbi, how do you define pagan?
Oh, the pagan then was a person who worshipped idols. There's various definitions now, which is not so, in other words, it's not so clear cut who nowadays is a pagan. But again, then it was pretty obvious. But again, what is is it clear that there's a contradiction here? Do people see that there seems to be a tension between the two sources? One source seems to be saying, look, forget the short lifespan, go to the pagan doctor, even if it means the person will die. The other source says, in source number 3, that no, don't forget the short lifespan, even if a leap of 5 minutes transgressed Shabbat to save him. Yeah, you have an answer?
I'll give it a shot.
Great.
It sounds like you, the person who has the opportunity to find out about healing yourself, you know, it's up to the person who's sick. And on the other hand, the first stage, it seems like if you are the one who's going to be doing the healing, you are obligated to take care of it.
It's a possible difference, although from point of view of Jewish law, we wouldn't actually look at that as an intrinsic difference because we'll see later, it doesn't really matter whether the person's making the decision or the person healing. But, yeah. Just before you ask your question, I'm sorry. I just wanted to get an answer to the question I just posed. So we'll just keep your question in mind. Right, let's try and answer this question first of all. The answer is the following. Tosfot. One of the great commentators in the Talmud school of commentaries, they answer in the following, they say, look, we always try for the person's benefit, the patient's benefit. Meaning, what does it mean the patient's benefit? If the patient is buried under debris, and we don't ignore the short lifespan, will that be to his benefit? No, because you'll let him die. If in the case of the pagan doctor, we ignore the short lifespan, is that for his benefit?
Yes,
because he may get totally cured. So Tosfot says we always do it. We always evaluate things for his benefit. In other words, if the experimental treatment may heal him completely, even though he's got a short lifespan without the treatment, you can do the experimental treatment, i.e. the pagan doctor. If, however, in the case of the person buried under a building, we ignore the short lifespan, then that would not be to his benefit, that would be to his detriment, and hence, we do not ignore the short lifespan. So again, just another principle. This, by the way, is a classic method of study in the Talmud, of Tosfot, is looking at a tension, an apparent contradiction between two sources, and by resolving it, have an understanding of an underlying principle in these two sources. So the underlying principle is, we go for his benefit, and if that means ignoring the short lifespan, we'll do that if it's for his benefit. And if it means not ignoring it, we'll do that also for his benefit. Yes, now to your...
I had a question. When we're talking about these cases here, and as soon as we have
Look, actually, as I mentioned in the training seminar I was at, for instance, in war, in the army, and in civilian life, there will be two different ways of looking at this. In the army, when we do triage, which is the prioritizing of medical treatment for the wounded, the way it works in the army is the person who's more likely to be able to recover and go back to the battle, you treat first. So that means the person treated first will be the person with the lightest wound, so that they will be able to go back to battle quicker, generally. Okay? The person who's less likely to recover will be treated last. In other words, the reason for that is that in times of war, since war overrides saving of life, because war itself is dangerous, so therefore we would operate certainly by certain different principles. This is according to Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg. Right, in civilian life, You may have a situation where it's not so clear-cut. For example, the question which is actually asked to Rav Oldenburg, who is actually, he is one of the great authorities in medical ethics in the world today. He was the consultant rabbi for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Jerusalem for many, many years. Rav Yehuda Behuda Voldemort was asked by a physician who worked in a small hospital. I don't remember where it was. I think it was South Africa, actually, but I'm not sure. And it was a small hospital. They only had one bed in the ICU. And the ICU was basically respirator one person. So the policy of the hospital was the following. Policy of the hospital was to not put terminal patients on into the ICU. They would reserve the ICU, the intensive care unit. Right? They would reserve the intensive care unit only for, let's say, accident victims who would have a high chance of recovery if they'd be able to get to the ICU. Now, the hospital prioritized that. That was their policy. However, they certainly, if there was already someone in the ICU who was put on there because someone ignored hospital policy, which also happened, they would not take him off for the sake of the accident victim. Okay, in other words, is this clear? So they prioritized the ICU for accident victims who'd have a high chance of recovery and would not a priori put a terminal patient on it in the ICU. However, if someone did put a terminal patient in there, they would not take him out and hence shorten his life to put in the accident victim. So is a Jewish doctor in the hospital, asked, can he, in good conscience, as a Jew, work in this hospital with such a policy? Rav Oldenburg agreed with the policy of the hospital. Rav Oldenburg said they are correct, because when you have limited resources, you are allowed to prioritize. And he says the priority generally should be also to the one who has the higher chance of recovery. That's what Rav Oldenburg understood. He says, but they're also correct in saying that you cannot take one off for the sake of the other. That we learn, if you have a look, number 11. Babylonian Talmud number 11 discusses this. It says the following. A man came to Rabba. Rabba was a rabbi. Rabbi Rabba. And said to him, the ruler of my city told me to kill another Jew, or else he will kill me. So he actually came to the rabbi and asked him what he should do. And if you're surprised by this, have a look at the literature of responsa from the Holocaust. You will find Jews throughout the Holocaust, the spiritual heroism, the moral heroism was incomprehensible. People would ask rabbis halachic questions in the midst of situations that are beyond our imagination in order to get a moral ruling. So this man came to the rabbi and said, look, the ruler of the city, it was in Persia, said, look, kill that guy or I'm going to kill you. He says, what can I do? What should I do? Now, clearly he's allowed to kill the ruler of the city because that's self-defense. No question about that. But he wanted to know, can I kill this other person to save myself? Rabbi said to him, be killed rather than kill. Who says your blood is redder than his? Maybe his blood is redder than yours. What does that mean? How do you know your blood's redder? What he meant to say is, well, there are different interpretations, but one of the interpretations is what he meant to say is this. You can never do an action to get up and save my life by killing you. I can't do that unless it's self-defense, unless you're attacking me. Right? But if it's not self-defense to kill one person, save another person, what are you saying by that? You're saying his blood is redder than his. That you cannot do. So to take the person off the ICU, out of the ICU, would be shortening their life, and that would be tantamount to saying, this guy's blood's redder than his. Yeah?
What about in the case of ICU, one is the patient is Jewish and the other is not Jewish?
Well, this is the Talmud is not talking about. Okay, the Talmud is talking about whereas both Jews. The average non-Jew at the time was considered in contravention of the Noahide laws, which means if they were idol worshippers, okay, what does that mean? The Noahide laws basically are, don't worship idols, don't blaspheme, don't murder, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't torture animals, and don't eat from live animals, and set up law courts. A person who they are all capital punishments, all capital crimes. So now, unfortunately, the state of society was such that the average non-Jew then was considered to be under a capital sentence, which means it would only be relevant here with two Jews. Okay. So anyway, but the rabbi said, how do you know your blood's redder? Maybe his blood is redder. How do you know his blood's redder? Maybe your blood's redder. Don't do a darn thing. Which meant that this person would have died. But that's what he said. Now, in addition, you're not allowed to sacrifice yourself also would not be the ideal. For instance, But let's get back to the point. So anyway, that's the triage issue to a certain degree. Reb Moshe Feinstein, by the way, disagreed with Reb Waldenberg in that case. Reb Moshe Feinstein maintained that it's on a first-come, first-served basis in terms of who gets the ICU. He says first-come, first-served basis. Yeah.
The reason I ask is, I think you have to accept that there is a moral baseline on choice and on resources. And without being a kind of Orwellian about this thing, you get into the kind of statistics of half of someone's medical expenses was spent in the last 3 years, and 90% was spent in the last 3 months. And how far into the generations will this, in terms of a public policy issue, will people be willing to carry people who are here in the ninth decade, the tenth decade? At what point does someone make this almost, life and death decision?
It's a difficult decision. Look, there are cases, that's not really, I don't have the sources here, but there are precedents in the Talmud, for instance, for discussion of this type of issue. I'll give you one example. It's a little distant example, but an example from the Mishnah in Gittin. The Mishnah in Gittin says, you're not allowed to redeem a captive for more than their value. What does that mean? Let's say someone's been kidnapped. In the ancient times, it used to be quite a thriving trade to slave trade. Jews, the Knights of Malta, used to be the big slave traders in the Mediterranean. People used to sell, the Caliph of Al-Rahman al-Nazir of Cordoba used to have pirates in his employ. They used to capture people and sell them as slaves. So the law says that you're not allowed to pay more, 1 cent more than the standard going price for a slave to redeem the Jewish captive. You're not allowed to pay a cent more. Right, why not? Why do you think you're not allowed to pay more than the going value for a Jewish captive? What do you think the logic behind that is? The ransom. Whatever. Let's say, there's a slave market then. So they're saying, slaves go $50, let's say. I mean, that's probably grossly understated. But let's say they say, the slave, they want for the Jewish slave, either you, Jewish community, ransom this guy for $1,000 or just sell him to Gentiles. Is the Jewish community allowed to pay more than 50? The answer is no. No. That's what I'm asking. Why? Of course. Who's going to become prime targets? Who's going to become prime targets? That's right. It reminds me of that Gary Larson cartoon in The Far Side. You ever seen this? You've got two bears, right? And one of the, two bears. And one of them's fur is in the shape of a target on his chest. And one bear saying to the other, he says, heck of a birthmark, Larry. But obviously, if the Jewish community will end up always paying more for the kidnapped victims, who's going to become the prime target? The Jews. So now, what if the kidnappers threaten the life of the Jewish hostage? What about a situation like that? Should you pay more then as well?
Yes.
Well, there is an opinion in the Talmudic authorities, this seems to be accepted, that even if they threaten his life, you cannot pay more. Why? Because what will happen? Exactly. Of course, they're going to do this for everyone. They're going to start threatening everyone's lives. So in other words, the good of the community, to a certain degree, is being placed on a priority here. There are some authorities, so there's an idea that there's a certain priority here. So again, let's get back to the euthanasia issues. A couple more issues I want to cover in euthanasia. Who owns life, number three? Who owns life? In other words, who's got the right to make decisions about it? Ultimately, we believe that only God has got the right to make the decisions. The human being in many Western countries, people understand it's my body to do with what I want. My life, it's my soul, I can do the heck I want. Okay, Jewish law does not look at it that way. Jewish law does not look at it that way at all. In fact, we would say that it actually is a crime. It's a crime to commit suicide. It is prohibited for a person to take their own life, and therefore the decision in general is not for me to make. There are apparently some. Now, this is actually a verse in Genesis 9, where the verse says, God tells Noah, Adam, he says, your blood from your soul I will seek payment for. What does that mean? Your blood from your soul I will seek payment. If you spill your own blood, then I will seek payment. If you spill someone else's, it's murder. But even if you spill your own blood, meaning that the person is held responsible for their own life and their own soul. We have a law, for example, in the Jewish court system, that if a person confesses to a capital crime, we don't accept their confession. We don't accept their confession. Why? Maimonides says, because maybe they're manic depressives who cannot pull the trigger themselves, but they go to court and confess to crimes, hoping the court will kill them. He says, we cannot accept that confession. The Radvaz there explains, because he says, Hanashamais Aniasisi. The verse says, the souls are mine, God says. It is not yours to confess with. You can't dispose of it as you want. I suppose in secular law, you have the idea of wearing seatbelts. Now, and I know it's been challenged, how can the government obligate you to wear seatbelts when the only person really who's been damaged is yourself? And some would say it's because the government is interested in healthy taxpayers. Some would say it's more than that. It also, the person who is injured is depleting the resources of the community. What right does he have to do so by acting in a negligent manner and not wearing a seatbelt? Jewish law says it is the community's business because the court's got to enforce the law of the Torah, and the law of the Torah says you have to act in ways helpful, and you have to act in ways which prevent yourself, not put yourself in danger, and that is a prohibition. However, there seem to be a couple of places where it's not so clear cut. Now, where it does seem to be clear cut, number 5, Avodah Zarah, says the following. Reb Chananya ben Trajion was wrapped in a Torah scroll and burnt alive with wet rags on him to prolong his death. The Romans did that to him. His student said to him, Rabbi, open your mouth, breathe in the fire. In other words, inhale deeply so you die quicker. He answered them, better that he who gave it take it away than a person damage it by his own action. Better that God who gave me the soul take it away than I damage it by myself. The Roman executioner asked, if I take away the rags and increase the flame, will you guarantee me a place in the world to come? Reb Chananya agreed, the executioner increased the flames by taking away the wet rags, and he jumped in himself. The executioner also died. And a heavenly voice declared, the executioner has a portion in the world to come. What we see, first of all, is Reb Chananya ben Trajion refused to hasten his own death, even though he was in tremendous pain. Interestingly, there's an apparent contradiction to this. Look at number 4. The tragic death of King Saul on Mount Gilboa. Actually, I was there last week for Shabbat at a kibbutz not far from Mount Gilboa, kibbutz Tirat Tzvi. There's Shabbat there in Beit Sha'an Valley. So Mount Gilboa, King Saul went up to Mount Gilboa. He was injured by archers. He was standing there with his sons. Tragic, tragic death. And he said to his armor bearer, kill me, so that the pagans don't take me. And his armor bearer was scared. And it says, Saul took his own sword and threw himself on it and killed himself. And we don't find that King Saul was criticized for doing that. On the contrary, we find that the Medrash Rabbah in Genesis says that that's an exception to the rule. The case of King Saul, he was allowed to commit suicide. So now, yeah.
I have a question. I know suicide is prohibited according to halacha. So if God forbid I was terminally ill and I call, let's say, Dr. Kevorkian, you know, is that suicide?
Absolutely. That's what we're looking at right now. In other words, first of all, do you have the right? We see in one place King Saul does commit suicide, and he is not criticized for it. And the Medrash Rabbah says, ach, et dimchem, however, that's a miut, to tell me that the case of King Saul is an exception. He was allowed to. And yet, Reb Chananya ben Trajion, also in terrible pain, did not want to hasten his own death by his own hand. What's the difference between the two cases? Again, question asked by Tosfot and the Ritva. Contradiction between two sources. Resolution will give us a principle. What is the principle that we derive from the resolution of these sources? Some commentaries say the following. The reason King Saul was allowed to commit suicide, it was not in order to alleviate his own pain. But you see, you have to imagine, King Saul was a king of Israel, anointed by a prophet. He would have been captured and tortured and paraded publicly by pagans. What would we call such a thing? A chilul Hashem, a desecration of the name of God. What greater victory for paganism? What greater public relations victory for the causes of evil, for the causes of impurity would there be than the pagans capture a king anointed by a monotheistic prophet and torture him publicly and have him as a prisoner? So King Saul was allowed to commit suicide rather than have that terrible, terrible Chilul Hashem, desecration of the name of God, tantamount to idol worship happen. That's why, by the way, that we have cases in history where Jews committed suicide in order to avoid being used for such crimes. There's a case in the Talmud of 400 teenagers who were being taken to Rome on galleys to be used in brothels. And they all, when they came up on decks, they brought them up on deck for air, they all committed suicide, they all jumped off the ship and died. They made a pact amongst themselves, they said, we know why they're taking us to Rome. And it was the girls initially who said this, and they said, we're going to jump off and die. And the boys saw their example and followed them. And the Talmud says they were correct in doing that. They're correct in doing that. In other words, to avoid being used for sexual immorality, right, was something they could do it for. So in other words, it wasn't the pain that they were trying to avoid, it was the sin, so to speak. Yes.
Is Masada correct?
Masada is interesting, because we don't know what happened on Masada. No one knows what happened on Masada. They committed suicide, but why? Josephus Flavius in the Jewish War has a speech of Elazar, the head of the zealots, which he made up. He doesn't know. There was no transcript of the speech. He was not wearing a little microphone or anything like that. It was not like, how does he know? Right? Well, someone with their Palm 7, you know, emailing it out, you know, off to Masada. So we don't know what went on. So according to Josephus, the Jews on Masada committed suicide because they said, Elazar said, and I almost quote, it is better to die by our own hand as free men than to live as slaves at the hands of the Romans. If that was the reason, that's prohibited to commit suicide. However, if they felt they were going to be tortured into idol worship, sexual immorality, and be used by the Romans for that, then it may have been justified. What's interesting is the Talmud doesn't discuss Masada at all. At least according to my CD-ROM, it does not discuss it. Right? And I can't say I'm that, you know, such a genius that I can tell you, but it doesn't discuss it. Even though the Talmud was written, edited in 500 CE, Masada happened in 73 CE, Talmud doesn't talk about it. Why, my conjecture is the reason it doesn't is because it doesn't know what went on. So it doesn't want to condemn it, doesn't want to praise it. So we don't know. And just one more source, because we have to break for lunch. We can't finish everything, I'm sorry. But that's the way, the ancient biblical expression, Zot HaDerech Shah Matzah Mit Pereret. That's the way the matzah crumbles. So anyway, now, but just one final source, the Code of Jewish Law. Code of Jewish Law says, two final sources, it's forbidden to cause the moribund to die quickly. In other words, if a person is anyway dying, nevertheless, it's considered murder to hasten their death. Anything that you do that will hasten their death is considered to be murder and is prohibited. However, what about someone who is dying and is in terrible pain? Someone who's dying, are you obligated to treat them? Are you allowed to pray that they die? So the Talmud says, number 7, there's a story that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Judah the Prince, author of the Mishnah, towards the end of his life, he had a terrible stomach disease of some sort. He was in terrible pain. The students were standing outside his house praying that he should live. His maid knew the pain he was in, and the students were not aware of the pain he was in. So she stood there, and what she did was she took a large pitcher and threw it out of the window at the students. It broke next to them. They stopped praying. Everyone looked up, they stopped praying, he died. And the Talmud says she was correct. She was right in what she did. Rav Moshe Feinstein deduces from here, that is, and in fact, number 8, also from Yehuda HaChassid, that although you're not allowed to hasten someone's death, but Rav Moshe Feinstein says you're allowed to pray that someone dies in a situation like that. That's in the hands of God already. If someone is dying and they're suffering, then you're allowed to pray that they die. Now, what can you deduce from that? We may be able to deduce, some authorities say, that you're not obligated to treat them. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you are obligated to provide them with oxygen and hydration and sustenance. But what about treatments that will only prolong their life when they're in terrible pain at this point? It could be you're not obligated. Because if you're allowed to pray that they die, it could be that we can deduce from here that you're not obligated to treat them. Are you allowed to shorten their life? In other words, we have to know, clear distinction, shortening life, removal of the vital necessities of life, like oxygen and hydration, that is tantamount to murder. On the other hand, are you obligated to treat someone when they are in pain and dying? The answer is not necessarily, according to many authorities, no. Are you allowed to pray that they die? Many authorities, Rav Moshe Feinstein and deducers from the Talmud, yes, you are allowed to do so. In other words, But it's not a subtle difference, but it is a difference which a lot of people make the mistake. Right? It is not the same to say that I'm not treating as to say that I am shortening. Shortening, active shortening of the person's life, active intervention to shorten, murder. However, not treating, maybe that it's permissible not to treat. What about something where you are, by alleviating, here, there are certain situations, I should point out, where the patient's decision does come into account, is taken into account. In terms of, there are cases that I know of where the quality of life decisions, for example, the patient is allowed to make certain decisions about that. For example, just a case, a friend of mine who had, friend of his, she had a choice between two different heart valve operations. One was a silicon, and the other was using an implant from a pig. The difference was that in one case, the operation was extremely dangerous, very risky, but you would be able to live a more normal life afterwards. I think it was the pig implant. The operation was more risky, but the life quality afterwards was much greater. Whereas the other case, the silicon implant, was a case where the operation was less risky, and recovery was quicker, but life afterwards, they'd have to take blood thinning drugs, and they would not be able to live a normal lifestyle afterwards. So they asked Rabbi Yashiv, a good friend of mine, Rabbi Akiva Tatz, asked Rabbi Yashiv about this. Rabbi Yashiv says it's the patient's decision to make here. In other words, because here it's very difficult to, here it's very difficult, right? In other words, you'll have a normal life. You won't have to take blood thinning agents or et cetera. You'll be able to do basic exercise and lift up things, et cetera. But the operation's very risky. But life afterwards is not so risky. The other case was the operation is not so risky, but life afterwards is very risky. That was in the patient's hands to decide, and that terms of quality of life. But again, unfortunately, we have not been able to go through a lot of the issues, but we've gone through some of the sources. I just wanted to give you an introduction to halachic methodology. That is to say, we look at the sources here, and we try to, and based on the reasoning that the Tosfot and the great commentaries use, we try to come out with a decision in a particular case. I should point out, every case has subtle differences that can make major differences in the halachic outcome. A non-expert in halakha, in Jewish law, cannot make these decisions. We cannot make the decisions based on this class, obviously. Right? Because every case can have subtle differences, which, if you're not an expert, you just know it is. Like if you look at a contract and you're not a lawyer. Oh, big deal. No, there's this, it says and or. Well, anyone who's done any contracts, does it sometimes make a difference, and or? How about a bank account? And or little dash, right? Big differences. And non-experts are a big deal, one letter difference, you know. But the fact is, so in medical ethics, the same is true. Minor, something which looks minor to a non-expert will be major to an expert. And hence, I should point out that the Jewish law requires this type of expertise. Another thing I should point out is that it is the experience, my experience personally from having been involved in cases like this, and the experience of people I know, is there is sometimes a lot of pressure which is put on relatives by the hospital staff to sign this, to do the DNA, and a person has to know that they should not to be pressured by the hospital staff to make a decision, right, based on moral grounds, on Jewish moral grounds, has to be done and consulted with a halachic expert, not based on pressure from family, pressure from friends, pressure from the hospital staff. Very, very important. Okay, that's it for the moment because it's lunch now, but I will take some questions. Those who want to stay, those who want to leave and eat, 100%. Thank you very much.